William Colby was director of the CIA from 1973 to 1976. His life, both as a spy and spymaster, and as a family man, is chronicled in a new film called The Man Nobody Knew, and joining us now is William Colby's son, Carl Colby, who wrote, directed, and produced the film. Welcome to our show for today's first backstory segment.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
There's always a concern with a film like this that it would be hard for a filmmaker to achieve a real sense of objectivity when he's making one about his own parent. Was that a problem for you?
Well, you might think so, and also there was an added problem. My father was a spy. He worked at erasing himself. He liked considering himself to be the last person you would remember at the reception last night, or he'd have the most difficulty getting a reservation or getting the maitre d's attention at a restaurant. So even though I've done profiles all my life on documentaries on Bob Marley, Frank Gehry, all sorts of people, and you would think, well, why didn't I turn the cameras on my own dad? And the thing is that he would go only so far in a conversation. Very pleasant, kind of the opposite of the great Santini, but he would only go so far. And if I wanted to ask something very personal, like, why did you divorce my mother? Or something along those lines, he would simply say, that's your department, friend. So I sort of thought I didn't have a way in. And then when he died and a few other things happened, I began to think, well, now I've got a shot.
Mm. Well, did he keep secrets all along? Did you have a sense of what he did when you were growing up?
Well, we pretty much supported the members of this club that we were not members of. It was like a little secret society that you met the members and they came and went, but you weren't in the room. You were excluded from the meetings. And
so they would show up at the house and then you would be sent off to do something else?
Well, sometimes they would be just around. I mean, if you think about it, a terrific cover is to be a family man. You can bring people into your house. They then feel that you trust them and they're trusting of you. And it looks normal.
Your father began his career before you were born, didn't he, with the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS?
Right.
What did he do there?
He was a paratroop. He paratrooped into Nazi-occupied France and Norway and helping local resistance groups fight the Nazis, blowing up Nazi troop trains and that sort of thing.
And he became kind of famous for it within that community. Did he talk much about that with you?
He would talk about that in when we'd make excursions around Europe when we lived in Italy. He would say, that's the ditch I lay in when the Germans marched by. And we would say, well, why didn't you shoot the Germans? And he said, well, there are only two or three of us in this ditch and there's 600 of them. So he was very much the adventurer. And I grew up thinking that he was a hero, that he was a war fighter. He fought the Nazis.
And did he want you to have that impression of him, do you think? Or was he just telling the story because you were passing that ditch?
No, he wanted us to think that he was that man. And frankly, in the end, he really was a soldier. And that's kind of the theme of the film.
So the CIA was founded in 1947 after World War II. Did your father automatically go into it from the OSS?
No, it was kind of a secret. He lived in New York. He was a Columbia Law School graduate, worked for the National Labor Relations Board. My mother worked at Abraham and Strauss supporting him. And he was a very liberal, democratic, labor activist lawyer. And then he was recruited.
And the CIA in the early days had lots of liberals, didn't it?
Yeah, it was a hotbed of really a lot of FDR fired up by, Day of Infamy.
But anti-communist liberals. Your father was sent to Italy by the CIA to help undermine the Communist Party there.
Right. It was a struggle, really, for the heart and soul of European nationhood. And would it go communist or would it become or stay Christian Democrat?
So what did he do? The Communist Party remained a major force in Italian politics until the fall of the Soviet Union. So was your father able to undermine it in any way?
Well, it was a little more dangerous than you might think. The partisans in Italy, the anti-Nazis, many of them had been communist, and they were armed. So when the republic, in a sense, when Italy became a republic, they were tilting mostly the men, frankly, the Tuscans in the north, to communism. And that was seen as a threat by the Americans because they thought, well, here comes the Soviet bear, and only a matter of time before it turns into either Yugoslavia or worse, Hungary.
So part of the approach was to make a connection to the Catholic Church and get it involved in Italian politics.
It was a natural marriage.
Is that what your father did?
Oh, yeah. He passed a lot of money, about $5 to $6 million U.S. at the time, and it was frankly the largest covert action campaign ever mounted by the CIA.
Were you in Italy at that point?
We lived in Italy. We lived near the Colosseum, and then later out in the Via Cassia near the prime minister's daughter. And I would see him with priests and clerics, and he was very quiet. He watched. He observed. He said, I already know what I think. I'm here to listen and learn what I can.
How much do you think your mother knew about what he was doing?
My mother was fully aware of his CIA affiliation at that point. And frankly, she euphemistically called it CIA, Catholics in Action.
Because she saw at least the activity in Italy as having to do with working with the Catholic Church.
Well, it's more than that. I mean, you're a New Yorker. Look at Fordham University and the connection to the FBI. There's a very strong Catholic sort of edge to the CIA, certainly in those days, and the FBI, because of the sense of mission. It's, I won't say evangelical, but it's proselytizing.
So what did you tell your friends and neighbors about what your father did when they asked you about him?
Well, surprisingly, growing up, most of my friends in Italy and in Vietnam, when I lived in Saigon, they all worked for the government. They were either CIA or military or some affiliate, or frankly, I even knew some of them who were covers. They actually were CIA, but they were pretending to be business people.
But you also say, frankly, he didn't have any friends. He must have been very lonely.
I think he was lonely, but he had that, remember, he had that camaraderie with his fellow CIA officers, and they were very tight and very close. It was like a club, really.
So he was friends with the other CIA officers, and everybody else was closed off. I remember this seeing this film recently about Valerie Plame, and when it came out that she had been in the CIA, all of their friends, the close friends, were outraged that they had no idea.
Well, maybe that was her experience, but frankly, I remember seeing Valerie Plame around Washington those years before the movie, and everybody knew she worked as an analyst at the CIA, so it's
kind of
Well,
maybe you were hanging
surprise.
Around with a different crowd.
Yeah.
Carl Colby is here. His latest film is called The Man Nobody Knew, different than his previous films because it's about his own father, William Colby, who was the director of the CIA from 1973 to 1976. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. As you mentioned, your family lived in Vietnam starting in 1955.
No, 59.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but that's still very early
very
in the story.
Early.
The French were still there, weren't they?
The French were really retreating, and the Americans were just coming in with special forces coming in to basically do eerily what's going on in Afghanistan now, the same sort of mission. Bring your top special forces in, let them do the fighting, and let them do the securing of the villages and even, frankly, nation building.
But we weren't officially involved in Vietnam until the Gulf of Tonkin.
Right. This was sort of the overreach of, at that time, the Eisenhower into the Kennedy administration. And the film really brings to bear how much, particularly John F. Kennedy and his brother, Robert Kennedy, intimately involved in the covert action down to the nth level.
What kinds of activities was your father involved in there?
He was very close to Ngo Dinh Nhu and to President Diem. We lived really 50 yards from the palace. He spent most of his time with the senior generals and with Nhu, trying to sort of bring him into a sense of ownership of the countryside. Saigon was controlled by the Diem government, but the villages and the countryside was up for grabs.
So your father was working as an advisor in an advisory role?
Well, more than advisor. He was
also friends with the Diems.
Oh, friends. And we would go up to visit them on their mountain retreat in Dalat and Madame Nhu, and we used to spend weekends together.
So what was his reaction when Jim was overthrown in a coup that had the support of our ambassador, William Cabot Lodge, and the U.S. government?
He was devastated, actually. He thought that had gone completely awry. He had faith in Diem. At least it was a bulwark, he thought. And then once he was gone, it would be a little bit like if Karzai, let's say, and his brother both killed. Well, in Afghanistan today, You've already kind of got a messy situation, to put it nicely, a bit unstable. Imagine how destabilizing that would be.
Well, wasn't the destabilization arranged through the CIA? So was he opposed to what was going on, or did he have to follow policy?
It was exactly what you just said. It's really following policy, even though he vehemently was opposed to it. Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge went out to Saigon, and within a few weeks, he deposed the current CIA station chief, frankly, because he had a bigger car than he had and a better house. And he wouldn't truck with any opposition to his plan to really get rid of Ziem. And he did it, frankly, practically on his own.
As the years went on, what was your father's reaction to the U.S. escalation and involvement in Vietnam?
Well, this would be something that your audience, you know, would have a hard time maybe understanding, but he stuck it through. And even though he vehemently was opposed to the mass, you know, invasion, frankly, of hundreds of thousands of American troops, he stood it out, stuck it out, hoping that at some point his program of sort of village-level resistance would take over. And frankly, when Westmoreland crashed and burned and Abrams took over around 67, 68, even though the Tet Offensive had just occurred, he had his chance.
But he was also involved in the Phoenix program.
Yeah, he was the architect.
Which is controversial.
Very controversial.
It utilized assassination and, can we use that word, torture?
Well, in the film, Bob Carey characterizes it as assassination. He felt that, be like today, if you're out in one of these countries that we're involved in and somebody tells you that that's the bad guy and maybe he's got, but maybe it's a personal grudge. Maybe he's your ex-brother-in-law or, you know, maybe you've got, he owes you money or, you know, who knows? The intelligence is sketchy sometimes.
Your father became a target of the anti-war movement. How old were you at this point?
I was 18, and suddenly I was at Georgetown University, and I was very much against the war because this was this country, Vietnam, that I had lived in as a boy, and now it's being destroyed. I mean, just literally burned and taken apart. So I saw posters of him comparing my father to Heinrich Himmler, and people would say, your father's a murderer. He's a war criminal. And first I would say, well, you don't know what you're talking about. But then I would read and see the reports of 29,000 or more Viet Cong, you know, taken out systematically in Vietnam. And I thought, well, he's fighting a different war. He's fighting the war that he knows how to prosecute. But I think he was in a bubble. I think he didn't understand, like the senior leadership and even Johnson at the time, that there was really no support for this war anymore.
I'd assume that there were some family debates as well. But you were just a kid. He wasn't going to listen to you, was he?
Oh, no, he listened a lot. I mean, in your audience, I'm sure there are people who used to have a pretty lively dining room discussion, let's put it that way. And everything was up for grabs. And his favorite expression would be, if you argued with him and disagreed, he'd say, well, fair enough, but try to see it my way. But I must say, by 69, 70, he was shutting down in the sense of trucking with any real opposition to his point of view.
During his time in Vietnam, didn't your sister also become ill? Were these postings overseas taking a toll on the family?
Well, my sister had always suffered from sort of an advanced form of epilepsy together with bulimia, anorexia nervosa, and I think she was very troubled and was very tough on my mother and the family. And my mother, you know, I first thought, well, I'll make a film about my father. And then as an afterthought, I'll interview my mother. And then it turns out she's the heart and soul of the story because of her courage. And she took on the suffering of my sister for my father.
Well, your mother has a lot of charisma, actually. What led to their divorce?
And you say charisma, too. I mean, it's really something I walk along.
Well, you know, she comes on the screen and immediately everything lights up.
She's a New York girl. She grew up in the village. She went to Varnard. She just believed in the cause. Even to this day, she'll say, where's my sacrifice? If we're at war on two fronts, then what am I doing? Why aren't I being asked to sacrifice? Very interesting point of view. And so the divorce was devastating for her because her entire world is flipped around. And then we all have to think, were we just a cover? What's more important? And frankly, I never did ask him that most direct question, as some children will ask of their father or mother. Who's more important, the job or me? I didn't want to ask that question.
Because you knew the answer.
Yes, sir.
How did he end up being appointed the director of the CIA?
That's actually still a question that I have. You wouldn't think he'd be the natural pick. I have a sense that Nixon picked him because he thought he could control him. He was obedient, tough. He took on the hardest, dirtiest, most illegal assignments given to him, so he would not be an opponent. But then when the fall of Nixon occurred with Watergate, I think my father felt, who should I be loyal to, the office of the president or some discredited president or the American people through Congress?
Well, the CIA is supposed to be an independent organization, but it's always been politicized, hasn't it?
Well, I don't think it was politicized in the early years, but the thing that your audience and you must know is that it's the president ordering these operations. Right now, this president, his hands are full. He's got a lot on his plate. He's ordering up as much, if not more, covert action than any president since JFK. And there's no real open debate about it. I'm not saying there should be secrets revealed, but why don't we have a discussion on the legality of some of these measures?
Well, it comes up, and then people rally around the flag, don't they?
I don't think so.
There's been a debate in the New York Times over whether the United States should be ordering the assassination of American citizens abroad, but most people are just dismissing the arguments against.
I find it very odd because, you know, you start that slippery slope, and I interviewed Senator Patrick Leahy, chairman of the Judiciary, Democrat from Vermont, and he said, what are we afraid of as Americans? You know, are we afraid to say, well, maybe perhaps these things are amoral and we shouldn't be doing them, and then act accordingly? It's a tough choice.
As you said, your father liked being invisible. How did he adapt to the very public role of being the CIA director?
It took him by surprise. I think he had been a clandestine officer all of his life. It's a little bit like one of those salamanders you see when you lift a rock when you're out hiking in a park, and suddenly he's exposed to all these flash cameras and testimony. And even Rumsfeld said that he didn't have the social or political skills necessary to deal with members of Congress.
And this is at a time when Watergate is bringing down the Nixon presidency and Vietnam is winding down.
I think it was an intense period of distrust on the part of the American people, and the Congress reflected that. The 1974 Congress, as you may remember, was just a whole new squad, young people coming in who had been left out of all the decisions, especially the Democrats, in comporting the war. So this was not to be anymore, and the gloves were off, and what has the CIA done? And those secrets then became revealed.
During the Church Committee hearings, which really led to changes in legislation that only were challenged during the Bush administration.
Yeah, I think the temptation on the part of the president, whether it be Bush or even the inner circles now, are let's avoid Congress. Let's not take this to the forum. Let's just do it. It's very seductive. You have a private army with a black budget, and you're good at denying things, and you can blame it on the agency if things go wrong. I'm not saying this is being done, but the temptation is overwhelming.
Well, a lot was revealed: assassinations, secret prisons, wiretapping Americans, foreign coups, psyops, MK Ultra, etc. Was your father involved in all of those things?
No, he wasn't involved in very little of that. He was involved in he was the architect of the Phoenix program, and he probably knew about some illegal operations over the course of time. But the CIA is very compartmentalized, so somebody doing secret prisons doesn't necessarily know about the making of toxins and that sort of thing.
How did your family manage this period? It had to have been very stressful.
Well, it was very debilitating at first because my sister died of those complications from her disease, and my father was being appointed and had his confirmation hearing. So it was a very tough period, and I think we had to take it on faith and hope and trust, really, that he was doing the right thing. And when he started to reveal the secrets, he became relaxed. We could tell just his whole demeanor changed. He finally found a champion he found a cause, something that was right, something that was legal, and something he had faith in.
And he was replaced by George H.W. Bush at the CIA. What did your father think of that?
I don't think he thought too much of it. His real aim was to reform the agency, and he thought the worst thing would be to put in a political person. Well, here we go. It pretty much launched George Bush's career, obviously, and the rest is history.
And many of the people from the Ford White House who served with him, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Alan Greenspan, George H.W. Bush, all went on to very successful careers. Your father pretty much left public life, didn't he?
Well, he gave some speeches and all, but I think basically he was done, and he, unfortunately for him, he became the sacrificial lamb. They wanted him to stonewall Congress. He wouldn't do it, so he was disposable.
What do you think your father would make of the CIA today?
I think he'd be proud that it was doing its job in terms of collecting intelligence and running some covert operations, obviously in places like Tunisia, Libya, Syria, elsewhere. But I think he might be concerned about overreach and about this death from above of the drones, because he'd rather capture that person and interrogate them and most likely turn them and have them work for us rather than just kill them from above.
Carl Kolbe's film, The Man Nobody Knew, is playing at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas and at the Quad Cinema. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today.
Well, thank you for your very insightful questions.